Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Are you ready?
Hey guys, come on, bring it in.
I have scrolled through my contacts, sent out the invites, and our guests are about to arrive. Welcome back to the podcast dedicated to the most precious human pastime. I'm Gregory Porter, and this is The Hang. This podcast is beautifully simple. I sit down with friends, idols, and inspirations of mine to discover what makes them tick.
I was so naive when I started. I didn't know any of these people. I mean, I was in a room with Randy Newman when I was 23, and he was saying, this record company likes you more than me. And he was like jealous of me, you know? And I was like, who's this old angry guy, you know? And now I'm thinking like, what? You know, like, holy shit.
Music runs through this man's veins.
Really started with Joni Mitchell. I started learning her songs, which are amazing. I was never allowed to like them, especially as a kid, because my mother was very jealous of Joni Mitchell. I mean, it was bizarre.
That's a song in itself, man. You got to write that song.
I know. That is a good song. Sorry, Mom.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Rufus Wainwright.
There's a funny thing. For some reason, I had to fill in for you. The media, everybody, they made a big deal. Gregory Porter, filling in for Rufus Wainwright. This was my big claim to fame for most of my friends.
So here, sit back, grab a drink, and let's do this. Come on. How you doing, Rufus?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
Where are you?
I'm in the fantastic metropolis that is Bakersfield, California.
Oh wow! So we're both in California.
Yeah. You ever been to Bakersfield?
Nice. I've driven. You know, we were doing a lot of camping before the fires.
Okay.
But we drove up to Lake Tahoe.
Uh huh.
So I think we drove by Bakersfield.
By or through.
And then we went. Yeah, and then we went to Sequoia and stuff like that. So yeah, I think we went through Bakersfield at one point.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, man. It's good to be back with you. Good to hang with you to talk about music and roots and politics or whatever we get into. The things that help us create what it is that we do. Yeah, I was thinking about where your musical influences, even the creative influences, where they come from. Okay. I have a couple of your songs that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I have many sources just because, you know, I was born into this business. Both my parents were and still are musicians. And then I've gone through opera and Broadway, and I seem to seek out inspiration constantly, which I think is necessary if you're an artist. But I do like to set the bar high, shall we say. That's my main objective, I think.
Yeah, is it because I was talking to Elvis Costello?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were talking about his children. You know, he's got two heavyweight parents there.
Yeah.
Elvis Costello and Diana Krall. When you come up in that environment, the bar is already, you know, there's a standard that is there.
Totally.
Did you ever feel any pressure or angst from that? Well, I had a conversation with Natalie Cole. Before she passed away. And we were talking backstage at Royal Albert Hall, and we were on a concert together. And I was telling her about this project that I had coming. And I told her, I said, this is your birthright. The music of Nat King Cole, the elegance, the aura, the all of that, that's yours. That's your birthright.
Yeah.
I'm borrowing it, and I've been able to borrow it and use it and feed off of it for all of my life. Right. But you're the child of that birthright.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, has it been a gift, sometimes a yoke around your shoulders?
I mean, I can't qualify it anything other than a gift. But I very much made provisions for it to be that way, in the sense that, you know, look, I grew up, when I first came to LA many years ago now, I was kind of dropped into this group of children of superstar musician people who were, you know, starting up them again themselves. And, you know, whether it was Sean Lennon or Adam Cohen or Chris Stills, I mean, these were all, and all of their parents were heavy hitters, as you said. And my parents, though not nowhere near as commercially successful as most of them, were nonetheless very respected, and my name meant something. I was able, thankfully, to, and this is really through my love of opera, I was able to kind of find a niche that was totally divorced from both of my parents, and a little kind of cocoon that I could, you know, grow into a butterfly in, which sadly I have to say was not always the case. For I would say the majority of my compatriots at the time. I mean, everyone, you know, there was such a serious struggle with legacy for a lot of those other people, and I seem to be spared it. I was also able to incorporate it into what I was doing as well. So I fared quite well, but. Yeah, but it's really an exception to the rule.
Right, it can be dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and I don't, you know, and I think Natalie Cole's an example, but there are a few, Liza Minnelli, but it's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
to have done that.
Yeah. But I mean, your writing is fantastic. And
thank you.
I like to think my mother wasn't famous. She was just a storefront preacher. And my father was a preacher as well. But he didn't raise me, and I never heard him sing. But people told me he was a great singer. That's what they said at his funeral. I'm still, even though it wasn't there, I'm still drawing from perceived genius. I never heard him sing a note.
Yeah.
But I'm drawing from the legend that I heard about at his funeral.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, a similar dynamic in my family is that, you know, my grandfather on my mother's side, McGarrigle side, not the American side, but the Canadian side, my grandfather Frank McGarrigle, he was born in 1898 or something, like at the end of the 19th century, and he sadly passed away in his 50s. So he died when my mom was 18. But he was this type of character who made a tremendous impression on everyone who met him. He wasn't an artist. He was, I think he, like, you know, whatever, like, bought and sold things, you know, dry goods or something. I mean, he just did something weird to survive during the Depression. But everybody was very charming. He loved to sing. He loved to play the piano. And he was just really fun at a party. And everybody who met him was always like, he was, like, such a lovely guy and such a kind of, I don't know. And he's the same character. I mean, I never met him by a long distance, by 30 years. And, but nonetheless, he inhabits my world incredibly largely, and Frank McGarrigle, and it's to this day. I mean, he's probably he's the guy I want to meet when it's all done.
That's cool. It's cool to have that type of a person. Like I was saying, my mother is that. She was just.
Yeah.
You know, bigger than life. I'm wearing a pink jacket today in honor of
Oh, nice. Oh, beautiful.
Of a breast cancer awareness. She passed away from breast cancer. And to have these large charismatic figures that you can pull from is really a nice thing to have in songwriting, and to have big characters, period, to inspire you. You wrote a song about the president.
Yes. I've written a couple of songs. one about America. You mean the one, the Sword of Damocles?
Yes.
The last one? Yes. Okay.
but the ability to, at the beginning of this, writing my last record, All Rise.
Yeah.
I was in such a state of angst, sometimes anger and, confusion about about our president, American president, and that the first five songs were about him. That's not my process. That's not what I do. And it was I was simply responding to something he was doing every damn day, and I was like, "That's what he wants. That's what he wants is to be front and center in your brain." And so I scrapped all that. And started from my normal process of which is coming from the organic feelings that I care about. He found his way into the record in a song called Real Truth, the desire to searching for real truth. ain't it ever the truth now?
Amen.
In the case in which he's,
I know.
In the case in which he is even at the point at which he now has a COVID infection, you still can't get a straight answer out of the White House.
That's messed up. I know.
I can't even and pray
they also
for you,
say
right?
That, I mean, I know, and they also say that, you know, technically, the people, the American people, are supposed to know minute by minute what's going on.
Right. If you get bit by too many mosquitoes, we're supposed to know.
This whole week, and I think up until the election and even after, it's going to be quite transformative, I think. Hopefully, in a good way.
I hope so. That debate. Even the point this story is almost biblical.
Yeah, no, I know. Speaking of Damocles, I mean, that was the only, you know, I when I wrote that song, I was really searching for a kind of parable or legend or, you know, a character in Shakespeare, you know, who that I could reflect on and that would maybe give me some answers in terms of what we're facing now. And I really couldn't find any, you know, I mean, there's really nobody like Trump that's ever been on earth or done what he's done now or to that extent and with that much success and with that much collusion, you know, around him, except for the Cicero story of the Sword of Damocles, which I even kind of read wrong the first time. I mean, I thought the song still works, but you know, the idea was that, you know, when you see the sword, it means that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and you know, you have to, you know, be careful and so forth, because it's you know, you're in a position of power. But then when I read further into it, it's like, no, it's like with great corruption comes incredible danger. Like for everybody, you know, all of those people have swords over their heads, and there's going to be, you know, a reckoning, because they've, I don't know, it's like a strength. It's almost like it is like a truth in a sense, like a kind of and we're all going to pay the price for it. I mean, it's the unfortunate thing.
Somebody was saying the biblical message, a proud spirit, a haughty spirit, and a proud spirit comes before a great fall, right? But the unfortunate thing is the subjects of that leader who has this proud or haughty spirit suffer as well.
as well. And then, you know, and the nation.
200,000 people dead.
I know.
And the unfortunate thing is about legacy, every president has legacy, is this unfortunate empowerment of the darkest parts of our spirits. It's already happened. It's already happened. We'll be dealing with it for 30 years. There'll be people emboldened to fight against gay rights, to immigrants, black people. He's excited those darker elements in our national and international personalities, and it won't go away when he's voted out of office. That's the unfortunate
thing. But there is a positive to that, and that now we really have to deal with it. And now we have to, you know, we have to wrestle it to the ground. I mean, the genie is out of the bottle. The genie was always there. So it's, you know, it's, I tend to be an optimist. And
for me, the big one
is the environment. That's the one where I'm a little more, you know, God, this is maybe not such a rosy situation here, especially in California, you know, these last few months, you know, especially, I mean, for you, it must be, I'm curious. I mean, cause you're sort of close to the, some of the big ones, right?
Oh man, we couldn't breathe for some days. You know, I stayed in my house and I was constantly changing my air conditioning filter and, you know, so it was, it's a problem. I mean, the fires and climate change, it's a real thing.
Right.
So not even, I mean, it's like childhood stories all over again. Let's put the wolf in charge of the sheep.
Of the hen house.
Right. You know, it's like we have positions normally reserved for people who are thoughtful and caring about the environment. Those positions are filled with oil barons and logging interests. And, you know, it's deep.
Yeah. But I have to say that with this coronavirus, you know, with the president finally getting the virus, I mean, that is definitely a plain That is assuming if this is all true, because you never know either with him. But let's say it is. That is a plain and obvious example of, you know, the karmic process, you know, and really trying to fight against science, trying to fight against, you know, nature, and how, and so that's sort of, I don't know. I think that's very, I mean, this whole period right now, especially with me, you know, the death of Justice Ginsburg, you're like, oh my God. I mean, could that have not been at the worst time? But then him getting COVID and then, you know, and then somebody, you know, whatever, so, you know, and so it's all stacking up now. And it's certainly an interesting play.
It's definitely drama. If you were sitting back and watching it and then completely and totally unaffected by it all, it would be entertaining. Listen, the cat is entertaining if he wasn't my president. Yeah. I mean, but don't think for a moment that humility will wash over him. This is a time for it, but I still don't see it. I still don't see it happening.
Yeah.
I still don't see it happening. And I pray for him. My brother, I know it's real. My brother died from, he was living, he's an actor. He was an actor in New York, lived in Brooklyn. He was that first wave in New York City. He died and just a year older than me.
Oh, I'm
and so,
so
he was
sorry.
Young and strong.
Wow.
And so that
wow.
this
oh,
thing.
I'm so sorry. So you're still.
I'm still in it. I'm still reeling. I'm still.
Yeah, you're in it. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I was very close to Hal Wilner.
Yeah.
You know, who passed, you know, Hal, he died. And then I know a bunch of other people. I mean, though they were mostly old, but older than what they're old. But Hal wasn't. And there was also a guy called Mona Foote, who was a kind of a young musician and, Yeah, so I've known a few people. I'm a little, I don't know about the second, you know, round here coming up, what to think about that. I mean, I have been like traveling and stuff. Like I went to Europe not too long, like about a week ago, I got back from Europe. And I mean, I've been tested a lot but I was in in that whole kind of trajectory, I was in four different environments. I started in the United States, which was one thing. And then I was in France. And then I went to Germany, and then I ended up in Sweden because they're doing my first opera there, Prima Donna, at the Opera House. And literally, I was on four different planets. It was four distinctly different worlds. You know, it started off in you know, I was in Blade Runner, leaving and going to the airport with the smoke and the mask. You know, so the start with Blade Runner. Then we get to France, and it's like some sort of slapstick comedy where like everybody's making fun of the masks and like nobody knows how to put it on and everybody's noses are hanging out and they're all like drunk and they like pretending like making jokes about it. Then you get to Germany and they're so organized.
Yeah.
And they have like this amazing system where like nobody wears masks outside,
right,
and everybody wears them inside, you know, and they only allow like a certain amount of people into stores and you know, it's like so. It's
you
like so
party,
even keel.
Can't then party get, too hard anymore.
Yeah, and they're all like doing this, and then you get to Sweden, and it's like nothing ever happened. No masks. All the bars are open. Everybody's hanging out, and it's just. It was very. It was really surreal. The whole trajectory of going to those four different places.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, for me, I mean, I put my money on Germany probably, but
yeah.
That certainly wasn't always the case.
I don't want to get into your citizenship business, but are you Canadian citizenship?
Yeah, no, I was able to go over with my Canadian citizenship, that helped. But it was really because my husband's German.
Okay.
And so I'm married to a European. So
okay.
That was the real,
okay, where you can
the
travel.
Real pass.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cause I mean, I have a gig coming up, soon, in San Diego, and some of my band members are flying from New York, and I'm like,
right,
that's going to be just the same as flying to Europe. I'm still am a little worried about it, but
yeah, no. I mean, I am worried that I'm not more worried, frankly. I mean, I have a tendency, which I think is natural for certain people. Certain people get, you know, too worried and too, you know, isolated and too freaked out, and other people are too lackadaisical. I'm probably more on the lackadaisical side, though. I wear a mask whenever I can, and I'm, you know, keep distance and stuff, but I push the envelope occasionally, unfortunately. But all of that aside, it's just, we need our leaders to like, we need government, you know,
right.
There
to
has
have
to
some,
be a guy. Yeah.
To have some clue.
I think that, yes, you should, if you are sick or if you're not taking precautions and you just are brazen and people get, you know, sick and die. Yes, you are to blame in a certain way, but not totally, because when you have a government that's not supporting the effort, it really takes away from your power to be able to do it. You know, it really distracts you and really fills you with this sense of just confusion, as you said, and I don't think that could be underestimated.
Hey guys, you're listening to The Hang. Hit subscribe or follow on your podcast thingamajig of choice to get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses. I lost a feeling, but you give me meaning again.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Your writing, I was just thinking about your writing, listening to, going through a lot of your songs, and do you feel like your song structures, and I mean this in the most positive way, lean towards the theatrical? I walk through your songs, I was like, this is total, this is absolutely needs to be on the stage. The way, and I love, cause I need to sing some of your songs, cause even the way just towards the end, you always let it fly.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. No, I mean, I was, you know, before opera came into play, when I was around 13, that's when I got the bug, the opera bug. Before that, I was highly affected by, you know, Judy Garland and Broadway musicals and also the Beatles. You know, they were always big when I was really young. So there was, needless to say, there was always a kind of more of a vertical structure than a horizontal one with my songwritings. You know, there's a lot of ups and downs and, you know, kind of obstacles and peaks and valleys that you have to go through. So I held on to that. You know, and I continue to write in that fashion. I will say, though, that simplifying my work, especially on my last album, you know, Unfollow the Rules, was one of my goals. I mean, I have learned that there is something to be said for just a direct approach, you know, and not trying to, like, you know, trip everybody up, but I try to do both now. But I love my early work where you really hear me, you know, trying to like bamboozle the world with my glamour or something. But now I'm kind of a little bit of that, but also a simplicity is nice. I find myself actually returning a lot to my folk roots, which is really where I came from. I mean, my parents were staunch, dedicated folk musicians, and that's a much, you know, that's a straighter path, shall we say.
Yeah. And did you, in terms of your musicianship, were you learning from your parents? Did you go to a conservatory?
Yeah, I mean, I took piano lessons for, you know, 20 years. Almost 20 years. And I did go to conservatory. I went to McGill in Montreal. I did terrible. I think I failed every course I took. but I was there for about a year and a half. Happy that I went. Was equally happy to leave, especially since my mother told me at the outset, she said, you know, Rufus, it's good that you're going to music school, but it's kind of more important you drop out because Bob Dylan dropped out of music school. and of course she was a big Bob Dylan fan, as am I. And, So that was sort of the plan from the get-go. But I'm very happy I went, and I kept my love of classical music burning, obviously. So that was good. And then, you know, I think one of the main things, and it's funny because I don't know if you have kids or not, but we have a daughter who's 9.
I have a 7-year-old.
And yeah, and this whole period is so
deep.
It's pretty deep, and it's hard to also separate it from, you know, what's going on in the world at the moment. Like, there's nothing normal about anything at the moment. But that being said, you know, I do remember, you know, when I was about 10, 11, she she's 9 now, but you know, when I was 10, 11, like really starting to like get obsessed with certain things, you know, and really following that call. And, you know, my mother was very excited when that happened. She didn't push me into that necessarily, though she, in a sense she did sometimes. Yeah, she did as any parent wants to push their kids, but it was really me who wanted to go there. And of course, I wonder with my child if that will be the case, which you never know, you know, you just don't know.
Yeah.
You just don't know.
Can we, back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, I look at my son and, you know, I'm trying to give him all the things that I thought I should have had. And so any little spark of anything, oh, did you see the way he did that? Yeah, that's just like me. He's going to be, oh, he's, yeah.
Yeah. That's like the outset of a disaster right there. Just like me.
It's so unfair. I'm like, let him do whatever the hell he wants to do. And I'll be very happy.
I mean, you know, I did this I've just completed an amazing project that's going to be coming out on Audible. You know, Audible, the company, it's like a kind of a podcast or something. It's called Road Trip Elegies. Anyways, but it was this very long drive that I took with my therapist, and we recorded it, and then we did 3 shows at McCabe's in LA, and we kind of interspersed my 10-hour long therapy session with music.
Wow.
With the songs that I sang, some originals, some of my parents' songs, some standards and stuff like that.
So it's actually a recorded therapy session
It's a recorded therapy session in a car.
In a car.
Driving from Montreal to New York.
Wow.
And then there's just in my family especially, it's a kind of legendary voyage, especially for my mother. And then for me, so it's that. And then I did 3 nights at McCabe's, and sang a whole bunch of songs that I kind of refer to in the session. And we kind of glued it all together, and it's pretty amazing actually. But my therapist, Mark, Stafford, who I'm talking to, he told me, and this gets back to what we were talking about, but he said, you know, when our daughter was starting to, you know, react and be, you know, around as, you know, develop. You know, I was very insistent on, you know, oh, well, I love this as a kid and I'm going to show her this and I'm going to take her to this. It's really important that she sees, you know, this movie or this work of art because I loved it when I was a kid. And he said, you know, the biggest mistake that parents make is to think that their kid is going to like what they liked when they were kids, you know, and, it's just, it's like, and feeling like they have to like it because they liked it.
Yeah.
And I had to, you really have to kind of swallow that pill at a certain point that's not necessarily going to be the case.
Right.
But then there's little things that surprise you as well, where they do get it suddenly.
Right. I think I was so excited when we would drive him to school every day in the normal time, way back when.
Yeah.
And he would pick the music. And he started to pick Earth, Wind, and Fire records.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
right.
I was like, oh. He's like, yeah, oh, I want to hear all that, you know, the horns and, you know, I want to hear that guy that sings real high. And I was proud of that. And then it was a lot of Michael Jackson stuff. And then I said, well, maybe I'll introduce him to some of my childhood favorites. The way it went in my household, before you watched the original, The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
You watched The Wiz. That's the way it went down at my house.
Right. Yeah.
So
I showed him.
So I was like, I was like, there's this movie, you know, it has a line. I tried to like whet his appetite for it. So I put on The Wiz and was sat back and was just hoping that he would love it. And he did. He really dug it. And
yeah, he did. Oh, that's nice.
And so
that's nice.
The things that I want him that are the things that I cherish. I don't just lay it on him. I give him like some breadcrumbs And if it catches, yeah. Cool. But if it doesn't, you know, maybe another time. But Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, stuff like that. You know, it's like, oh, you gotta love Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah.
The sound of music, you know.
We try.
I feel like there was all of these rich things that we could go to had a moral message, and it also had some good entertainment value and some skills. And so I just want him to have, you know, all of that stuff, because right now everything is so, it can be, if you don't look for it, it can be a lot of bubble gum happening.
Yeah. Oh no. No. Well, what we do with Viva, our daughter, is that and this makes it far more interesting for us, is that we just watch a lot of old movies, you know, from the 50s and 40s and 30s, you know, classic Hollywood movies and, you know, musicals and even, you know, kind of serious ones, you know, they're so tame compared to, you know, what's out there now. And it's very fascinating because on one hand you watch them and there are certain ones and often like we'll buy, you know, like, we'll get like a Barbara Stanwyck box set or Elizabeth Taylor box set. And there's a lot of movies on there I've never seen, you know, and we're guaranteed that they're going to be, you know, PG or whatever. And they are usually even the, you know, noir films. And, so we watch them and there are some that are amazing and so entertaining and so kind of like, but stand up so well. And then there's other ones which are so dark, not because of the story, but just the way they looked at the world. I mean, like talking about Black Lives Matter. I mean, like where all the servants are, you know, idiots and black. And then the women are just like these sex objects. They have no intelligence. I mean, and it's almost more of a kind of, it's interesting because we talk about it, you know, and she knows. She can tell, like, oh, that, I don't like that movie because, you know, that's not the way the world really is, you know, or it shouldn't be that way. And it's been a fun, and we talk about that stuff. Like, you know, this is something you can't do anymore. You know, this is not the way the world is now. So, but it's interesting.
What language are you speaking in the house?
Well, I mean, we speak English. I mean, my husband speaks German. I speak French sometimes. She goes to school in French half time, a lot. She has half English, half French. So she knows French. Our little dream, you know, is to at some point, hopefully, have a nice European period. Yeah. Especially after what's been, you know, this situation going on these days, and spend some time in France, living in France, and hope, you know, if her mother wanted, you know, because her mother's actually French as well. So we'll see. I would love that to happen.
That's my dream too. It's a lot of people's dream, but my dream too.
Yeah, especially at the moment.
And when you look at, can I just back to your operas, and are you always writing in English? I haven't explored all of your operas.
I've written, in terms of my operas, I've written two operas, you know, the first one, Prima Donna, which is in French, and that's, you know, that's had seven productions, all over the world. And there's a new amazing one that I went to visit in Sweden at the old opera house there, the Royal Opera House, which is really, I mean, in this day and age and with what's going on, the idea that, you know, like my entire, you know, world tour has been canceled and like the release of my new album was totally, you know, it wasn't a disaster, but it was minimized, shall we say, by the COVID. But they're doing my opera, you know?
Yeah, but you've got something going, man.
Yeah, I've got it, but I'll just go to my opera, you know, instead. That's really surreal.
That feels good.
That feels good. That's a good feeling. And then my second opera, Hadrian, which premiered about a year ago, that is in English. And there's some, you know, there's some, that has a future as well. So yeah, and then I'm doing, you know, and what's interesting though about the COVID situation though is that this is the perfect time to start thinking more about theatrical projects, Because you need that lead up time. You know, you need that 5 years to really hammer out the story and the music and the production and the casting and everything. So it's actually quite a fruitful time in that respect to shift gears and really focus on the theater.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what comes out of this period, this time. I've been careful with myself in terms of, you know, when I pick up the pen, because I'm so right straight from my heart. And at the moment, you know, I'm still heartbroken. So I have to be careful, you know. Everything, you know, come out that way? And if it does, you know, so be it. But but that's definitely what happens. In the history of your writing and being influenced by Dylan,
yes.
Were you trying to, beginning of your career, even now, are you still draw on that influence? Are you trying to connect your life experiences to
the interesting thing with Dylan is that, you know, both of my parents were, you know, Dylanites or whatever, however you want to put that. You know, they were and to this day are, you know, my mother passed away, but they're, you know, they're staunchly, you know, indebted to him and they worship him like he's a god. And there's no real minimizing, you know, the effect that he had on them. I kind of shied away from that for a long time. I thought that I would hear Dylan songs and I'd say, oh, that's really interesting. But it wasn't where I kind of went away from it in a lot of ways. As well as most of that era, you know, with my love of opera, I just sort of, that opera became my resting place. Anyways, but now it's funny because what's happened is that first really started with Joni Mitchell because we became friends with her, and my husband became a huge fanatic. He didn't know her music at all growing up in Germany, but later he discovered it when he was here, and he's like a real Joni Mitchell crazed person, and we did. And I started learning her songs, which are amazing. I was never allowed to like them, especially as a kid, because my mother was very jealous of Joni Mitchell.
Wow.
My mother kind of was, yeah.
That's a song in itself, man. You got to write that song.
I know. That is a good song. Sorry, Mom. And I honestly couldn't have sung her songs until my mother died. I mean, it was a bizarre. It was that bad. Anyway, so because they were, you know, both Canadian. Beauty, two Canadian beauties. So that happened, and I do adore her work, but then it moved over because the next one person who, you know, I was always compared to Randy Newman growing when I started, just because I was working with Lenny Wernker, and there was, you know, the Mo Austin was around, and it was sort of this, there was this, you know, piano based LA, you know, making records in LA. But I didn't get Randy Newman at that point. You know, I didn't really understand. I mean, I knew his hits, but I didn't really kind of dig deeper. Anyways, when it came time to make this record, Unfollow the Rules, and I was working with Mitchell Froom, the producer who works a lot with Randy now, I listened to some of the work they did together. And then I started really going into Randy's catalog. And then I learned that none of his songs are about anything personal. All of his songs are completely fabricated in the sense it has nothing to do with his own life. Like all of those situations, all of those observances are just completely divorced from his own personal life. That I found so fascinating because it was so different from my approach, and subsequently fell into this very intense Randy Newman obsession. I love Randy Newman now. I think he's, I'm just so excited. I mean, the thought now that people compared me to him is so, this blows my mind now. Then I didn't really understand it, but now I'm like, you were comparing me to Randy. I mean, he's one of the greatest. I think there's just something about him that's really striking the chord. And then once the COVID, you know, Trump presidency, you know, end of democracy, fall of the world, environmental. That's now the Bob Dylan stuff is really talking to me. Now the Bob Dylan's like, oh, I get, you know, I'm really, you know, I've been singing his work, especially, I mean, I did a lot for this Audible project, but, you know, whatever. There's a darkness in his material, which right now is particularly potent and relevant. And so it's kind of, it's coming around.
it will wrap up soon, but sonically developing your sound. Did you lean towards him? I was just watching a clip of you on a 2003 performance on Letterman.
Right.
I wish I could remember the song. Forgive me.
Yeah.
She had some background singers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your approach just reminded me of Bob Dylan, just in the uniqueness of it. Like, I don't give a damn if you catch it. Read the lyrics after I'm done, you know?
Yeah. Well, that might have been through my mother or my dad.
Yeah.
Who in turn, they were influenced by Bob Dylan. I wasn't cognizant of it, but which I have to say was, in retrospect, was a great advantage that I had when I came to Hollywood early on, is I didn't know any of these people. I mean, I was in a room with Randy Newman when I was 23, and he was saying, you know, this record company likes you more than me. And he was like jealous of me, you know? And I was like, who's this old angry guy, you know? And I'm like, and now I'm thinking, like, what? You know, and you know, like, holy shit. Like,
why wasn't I taking pictures?
Yeah, yeah, you know, if I'd known, like, the actual, like, dynamic of that, it would have been, thank God I didn't. I was so naive when I started. And that's probably one of the most important things, is to be as naive as possible.
This is very good.
Can be.
Yeah. Yeah. I call it a healthy ignorance, because it can it can lead to authenticity.
No, totally.
Yeah. In all of this craziness, I am thankful for my friends, and I'm thankful for my family, and I'm thankful for my son. These are the things that I'm most thankful for and keep me on the ground and keep me optimistic. What are some things that are keeping you optimistic in this time?
Well, I mean, I don't think that my situation is in any way comparable to what people who are really struggling are up against, you know, in the sense of, if you're, you know, a low paid worker, if you're a healthcare person, if you're elderly and in an old person's home. I mean, I am constantly just thanking my lucky stars and so grateful for all the gifts that I've been given and my having my health and so forth. And it's really a time to count your blessings, and to be ready to help those who are less fortunate. And so I'm in that mode. I need to do more of that. Now that I've said it. But I think that's the answer. I mean, it is about service, obviously, now.
Yeah.
Just for those who are really struggling with this. And a lot of that, and also there's, I mean, in terms of the political situation as well, you know, we have to rebuild this society and this system, and we have to be for our children. We're lucky to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, my friend.
Founding, refounding. Okay.
we are the founding fathers. Ooh.
We are the refounding fathers and mothers.
Ooh, I'll give you 10%. I'll give you 10%.
Okay. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Rufus Wainwright, thank you so much for hanging with me.
Oh, it's good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you again and have conversations. You know, there's a funny thing. I have some friends who they don't really follow my career. For some reason, I had to fill in for you. I don't know what happened. You got sick or the money didn't come through. I don't know what it was.
But
everybody, the media, everybody, they made a big deal. Gregory Porter is now filling in for Rufus Wainwright. This was my big claim to fame for most of my friends. They don't give a shit that I do 250 shows a year all around the world, opera houses and dives. They were like, you filled in for Rufus Wainwright?
Oh, my God.
Happy to oblige. So anytime you're canceling gigs, make sure you mention me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Life's back the same thing.
That's it, my friends. We've reached the end of another fantastic episode. I want to say thank you once again to the wonderful Rufus Wainwright. And a huge thank you to you for listening. I'm loving our time together. Shall we do it again? Okay. In a click, perhaps. Remember, feel free to share this podcast with your friends. Let's all get together on our next episode. I'm Gregory Porter, and this has been The Hang, a Cup and Nuzzle production.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.